tonight I wanted to talk about, I think, which is one of the biggest struggles or one of the biggest problems people have when encountering meditation. And I guess really I want to say, if there's one thing you hear me say tonight, hear me say this: thinking is not the problem. Thinking is not the problem. Often people get into meditation and there's a feeling, there's an attitude that if my mind is thinking, then I'm not meditating anymore. And that meditation, the only meditation is those moments where there's no thought, and then I'm doing it right. And then if I start thinking, oh, now I'm not doing it right. A lot of people come into meditation with that wrong view or that wrong attitude that we're trying to eliminate thinking. Which is really, really drag if you have that attitude, because, man, it's really hard to eliminate thinking. You know? Thinking is not the problem. So I wanted to talk about this word in Pali called papancha, which is... papancha in many ways is... I want to talk about it in a couple different ways. But really what papancha is, it's the activities which drive mental anguish. Or the activities which drive mental suffering. That type of thinking where we just are, in our minds, just having a bad time. And if someone were to say to you, the only, you know, that the benefit of practicing Dharma, of doing meditation, is that you can eliminate mental anguish, that alone would get me pretty psyched about practicing. That actually you can be free from that. Is really, in many ways, the first fruit of practice and ultimately the final fruit, I think, in many ways. And so papancha is a Pali term, and it can mean a number of different things. The list I have here is it can mean like an impediment. It also can mean like cooked up, spreading out, kind of that part of our mind that is just immediately, as soon as you start to meditate, you shut your eyes and the mind races out into what you could call mental proliferation. Overrun by thoughts. And really what it is, it's the source of our conflict and mental anguish, is this papancha. It's not all of our thinking, but it's a huge part of our thinking, is this mechanical aspect of papancha. Now, if you look at experience through, like, one of the ways the Buddha talks us to examine our experience is through the sense experience. Now, I would imagine most of us living in American culture that we do, we probably don't experience a whole lot of suffering through our sense gates, right? You probably don't eat things that taste horrible. Smell, even a really bad smell is not that bad. Physical experience, you know, sometimes we get a little bit of that, but not so much. Sight. And so really it's interesting to think about, like, how much suffering do I take on through my senses? Not so much. I think probably the one that causes me the most suffering is actually sound. And that a lot of times goes through with just communication with other people. The things that I hear actually cause me more suffering than probably any other sensory experience that I take in. And so that leaves us with where does most of my suffering take place? Well, it takes place in the sixth sense of the mind. That's where a lot of manufacturing of distress or anguish or suffering or whatever you want to call it, it takes place in that world. I'm not getting it through other experiences so much. And so in many ways what we're trying to do in mindfulness and when we start to practice the Dharma is we really want to try to understand the way that works. There's a poem that the Buddha, I want to read because I think it's really cool. He talks about, the Buddha once described the sense of samvega, which samvega means terror or dismay. And this is what inspired the Buddha, actually. This poem is the Buddha speaking before his enlightenment, and really what inspired the Buddha to even engage in this practice of awakening was this terror and dismay, just this sense of difficulty, fear, the fact that being alive sometimes is just a tragic experience, you know? And he says this: I will tell of how I experience Samvega. Seeing people floundering like fish in a small puddle, competing with one another, as I saw this, fear came into me. The world was entirely without substance. All the directions were knocked out of line. Wanting a haven for myself, I saw nothing that wasn't laid claim to. Seeing nothing in the end but competition, I felt disconnected. And then I saw an arrow here, so very hard to see, embedded in my heart. Overcome by this arrow, you run in all directions. But simply on pulling it out, you don't run, you don't sink. And so what the Buddha's really saying is that that which drives most of our anguish or most of our suffering is this kind of this arrow in our own heart that we don't know that it's there. But we're always running in all these directions trying to escape the unescapable. And I love the analogy of, like, you know, the seeing people as being like fish in these small puddles. It's almost like a fish out of water just barely surviving, and seeing that there's just no escape from that. And so that's what really moved him. And so, as a word, papancha is notoriously hard to translate. So I kind of gave you a little bit of an idea as to what it can look like. So instead of understanding this word maybe as like a definition, it can be really important to understand papancha as kind of the mental labeling that it takes root in our thinking, like how it shows up in terms of mind activities. You know, what is it that kind of gets this whole thing in motion? And in many ways, meditation, we, you know, papancha, as much as it might be something as a word you're not familiar with, you've seen it so much. You actually live there most of the time. As soon as you close your eyes, like papancha, your mind, just the mental proliferation just kind of spreads out. And so it's good to know, like, to differentiate papancha from thinking, because what I'm saying is thinking is not all the problem. It's not the problem. And all thinking is in papancha. Obviously, there's a lot of thoughts that we have that aren't suffering. There's a lot of ways in which we think that is useful to us. Thinking is a very valuable tool in many, many different ways. We've all experienced thoughts that are pleasant. So it's not this doomy, gloomy, all thinking is suffering, which is a lot of times people interpret the First Noble Truth as that. That if I'm thinking, it's suffering and I need to stop my thinking. It's like, that's totally not going to happen, and it's totally not what we're trying to do here. We're just trying to understand the ways in which we begin to get pulled into what the Buddha calls papancha, the way in which our thinking kind of gets characterized in a direction that becomes unwholesome. Right? That becomes sort of greedy, hateful, confused. And so we want to be aware of that a little bit. And so when we practice mindfulness, for example, when one of the first things that we learned is kind of, I want to talk a little bit about the stages, kind of maybe that you can tap into right away, but really need to practice over the course of a lifetime. And so one of the first things that we learn in mindfulness, even if you've taken like an MBSR class or if you learned about mindfulness in a clinical world from a counselor or a therapist, one of the first things they ask us to do in mindfulness is to try to experience thinking not as subjective. So my thoughts, my fears, my worries, my guilt, my shame, my past, my future. We're trying to make a little bit of a shift from mind to just. So it's just a thought, it's just a feeling, it's just a plan, it's just a memory, it's just a judgment. And so what that does is it gives us a little bit of an initial break from thinking, from being totally identified with all my thoughts, to instead of being my thinking, it's just thinking. And everybody thinks. And everybody experiences suffering through thinking. We know that. But what we're being asked to do on an initial level is to just break that initial attachment from everything that goes on in my mind as me. Now for me, that initial shift is a very subtle shift, but for a lot of people, it can be a very, very profound drop in experience. When I started practicing meditation, many of you know my story, but you know, I was 18. I had just witnessed my girlfriend get killed in this car accident, and my mind was just horrible. And so I'd gotten so traumatized and so pulled into my mind that everything that arose in my mind, I took it as mine, and I actually took it as true. So any thought that I had, I just totally believed that it was true and that it was the way it was. And I was very identified and really attached and very much lived in the world of my mental papancha. The only thing that existed in the world was my mind, and it was fucking horrible. Right? And so when I started to practice mindfulness of breathing, which we just did, when I was able to make that initial shift of my thinking, my painful past, my horrible life, to life is horrible for a lot of people, just horrible, just thinking, you know, making that little tiny shift in just perception, I guess you could say it. It was really a perceptual perspective shift that I was able to see clearly through mindfulness of breathing. To able to see that, oh, if I can get out of here, oh, cool. I can breathe, I can know I can breathe, I can hear the birds outside of the window. Actually, I feel okay. You know, my sensory experience is actually not so bad. And so that initial drop for a lot of people that I work with in jails and treatment centers, when they get that first hit, they're like, oh, this is fucking great. And it might only be like a moment, and then they're back in again. And so that's a very subtle shift, but a huge shift for many, many people who are experiencing a lot of mental anguish, right? And so that's kind of the first way we can start to, and of course, that's only the tip of the iceberg too, which is really cool. And so we're moving from the subject, I, mind, thinking, identification, into more of an objective experience, which is very useful, but ultimately not enough. And what we're trying to do ultimately is to move from subject to object to processual, to seeing that actually even the objects in and of themselves are not permanent, are not lasting. And so we're trying to even get even a more radical shift into seeing actually not so much it as object, but as process, as a rising and falling experience, to see that things are coming in, they're going, they're coming in, they're going. And to actually see the Buddha psychology is often translated in this teaching the Buddha gave called dependent arising or dependent origination. And what we want to see through that process is that actually things are, how does papancha show up in terms of a process? You know, how did I get from here to here? You know, I'm in a state of bewilderment and emotional anguish, and I'm really lost in my mind and my emotion. Well, how did I get here? Right? It just didn't just pop out of the blue. There was a process of papancha, a process of thinking that I followed, and we actually think ourselves into the corner. You know, like like painting yourself into the corner. We actually think ourselves into the corner much of the time, where we're like, oh no, I'm screwed. And it's like, no, I'm actually not screwed. But we think ourselves into these corners. And so this is why the objectifying or just treating things as object can be very beneficial, but ultimately in long-term practice doesn't work very well. And so with the Buddha, there's this term, modern term called phenomenology, which is really what the Buddha was really actually the first psychologist, really kind of a scientist of the mind, of physics. And he really was very interested in just completely rejecting all of the spiritual traditions of his time. And said, you know, he really was like, you know, what is really going on here? Like, really? Like, what is happening? And just a way of the way the processes of our mind work. And the reason why objectifying is oftentimes very it's not the end result, even though it might provide some relief, is because of the fact is because we place importance on objects, obviously. We're not very objective towards objects, if you know what I'm saying. And so because of like craving, or because of desire, or because of clinging, we have a relationship to objects that's not very neutral. And so even though we get a little bit of a break from subjective to an objective experience, the way we crave for what we want, the way that we have desire, the way that we kind of shift and move pulls us into this process that we're actually trying to be aware of. And it's really hard to be aware of a process if you're actually in it. And so I can't get too into it because it's a whole nother talk, but dependent origination in many, many ways can be broken down into moving from, there's 12 sort of links that we go through in our moment-to-moment experience. And it starts with ignorance, and it ends with suffering. So how does one move from ignorance to suffering? And interesting, right in the middle of the 12 links is craving. And that's kind of what pulls us forward. And when we talk about ignorance a lot in Dharma practice, I think it's important to maybe redefine it a little bit. I think when we use the word ignorance, we use it in a way that's not really true to the roots of what that word is. And so ignorance from a Buddhist perspective isn't like I'm an ignorant person. A lot of times we just think it just means I'm like dumb, basically, not smart. And really when we're working with ignorance, we're just seeing that we actually ignore. And we just don't want to know. Sometimes we just don't even want to know. So ignorance can almost be likened to like denial. We just don't even want to know what's true. And it's almost like the solid ground that we walk on, the solid ground of ignorance, of just ignoring what we know to be true and pretending that it's not true. Like really simple things like impermanence. We talk about that in here all the time. We often ignore that shit's changing. We're like, no, this is totally going to last. This is going to last, and it's going to satisfy. Those are two big things that we ignore constantly. And those are two of the three marks of existence that the Buddha speaks about in great detail. But we ignore it. We ignore that things are changing. And we ignore that. We think that it's going to stay, and it's going to satisfy. Right? And so when we get pulled into that aspect of our experience, it's like that moves us through. That's kind of what is the fire that fuels this papancha, the ignorance, the not understanding, or the not even wanting to understand what's true. And so as we lean back in our meditation, we get some relief from moving into not taking everything so personally. You know, even in the fourth foundation of mindfulness, it's, you know, the Buddha even calls them mind objects. So we want to be more aware of the objective experience. We want to be more aware of things like judging and comparing and just the subtle aspects of it. And that gives us a little bit of a break. And so as we move through these stages, if we want to be aware of this process, we actually want to be in some ways aware of our thinking and how do we get from ignorance to suffering. How do we get from this place of just denying certain truth about our lives and then end up in a kind of papancha, repetitive circle of mental anguish and negative emotion? And we're like, how did we get here? You know how you got there. A lot of this stuff is habit. It's stuff we've been doing for years. And many of us, we could sit down with another person and spell it all out. I do this, and I do this, and then I feel like this, and like this, and like this. And then we just kind of get pulled into it again. You know, we kind of participate in that. And the practice that we're trying to cultivate is we're trying to swap out ignorance with wisdom. Which can be a painful process, actually. Because what happens is, as we swap out ignorance for wisdom, our mind is more in line with reality. And we become less likely to give into the habits of papancha because we know how dangerous it is. We know that it doesn't work. And we know what those driving habits are that pull us into where we know we're going to end up in some place of emotional distress. And if we're mindful, if we're aware, we see those things arise and we're like, okay, now I'm seeing that there's a process that I can decide to not participate in if there's enough of wisdom. And like everything in the Dharma, when we talk about papancha, there is a list of things that we kind of, that I like to call sort of the three fires of papancha. And oftentimes the Buddha would relate things, craving with fire, because of course they didn't have electricity back then and fire is such a cool thing. But if you ever look at a fire on a log, you can see how the flames sort of cling to the log, right? They sort of grasp at the log. And that's what keeps it going, is that fire. That's what keeps the fire going, is sort of that grasping. And so the big fire of papancha, of course, is craving. And a lot of times, without the wisdom aspect, we crave for things that we know don't work, that don't last, but we do it anyway. And a lot of times when we work, and so the other aspect of that, so there's craving, and then, of course, the other piece is self. Is that we have such a strong sense of self, which is really what drives a lot of our craving. And so oftentimes they would ask the Buddha, well, who craves? Like, you know, what's the part of us that craves, or who's the craver? And he would always avoid those kinds of answers, because in the process of dependent arising, it's not about who craves, it's about what is the condition that makes craving arise. What is the stage before craving that would even allow craving to arise in our experience? And in dependent arising, right before craving, we have feeling tone. We talk about that in mindfulness. And because of things being pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, that is what gives rise to craving. It's not about me. It's not about there being a craver. It's about there's a process. Well, when you come in contact with a pleasant experience, you're going to crave for it to stay. Right? Of course. Not even your fault. It's just how it is. When you come into contact with a pleasant, unpleasant experience, painful, you're going to crave for it to be gone. And if you come in neutral, becomes kind of an interesting area to explore, because usually for a lot of us in neutrality, we just maybe get bored or we're not sure what's going on, become confused maybe. But we can see that. So the condition for craving to arise is just the relationship we have to our pleasant and unpleasant feelings. And so papancha, what it does is it kind of lives off of this perpetuating reality. So if we start to give in to craving for pleasant thoughts or craving for some experience in the future that is going to be good, that we can look forward to, that is going to be permanent and make us happy forever, that fire, papancha lives for that shit. It's like, yeah. Do that. Come on. Let's go. Let's get there. Let's do it. Let's get it done. And so it's this craving in the mind object of like, okay, it's pulling me into that. And the sense of self is going to be satisfied in this other experience. And it kind of feeds on that. And the third part that where papancha kind of in three stages, or if you look at it as like a circle, the things that keep the circle going, is our attachment to fixed views and opinions. Do you have fixed views and opinions? I have a couple. And so as we get pulled into papancha, we get pulled into this fixed view or even this judgment or this self-judgment that even people who come into meditation a lot of times carry with them a negative self-view or even something as strong as self-hatred, which is something that a lot of people in our culture have. And it gets born into this fixed view, opinion, view of self, which is, of course, in the craving and the self. Those three kind of perpetuate around themselves. They're like the three fires on the log. And now a lot of times, you know, if you look at the world, or you look at the relationships we have with other people, that often is what gives rise to papancha, to mental distress. It's just that, like, we don't agree. And I want you to see things my way. Because I'm fucking right, and you don't know what you're talking about. And if you look at just the status of the world, you can see that is in play everywhere. And so it not only does papancha occur internally, but it actually occurs externally and then kind of back in again. So there's like this relationship we have with our own papancha, and there's the relationship we have with everybody else's papancha. And it's always, as I said, papancha is hard to define, but there's one consensus is that papancha is not good. It's negative. It's what creates mental suffering, mental anguish. And so it really feeds on this fixed views, opinions, attachment to those views and opinions. And so what we want to see as we move from just being a subjective experience to an objective experience, you can lean back even farther and see the process of which how my attention is pulled towards what's pleasant, my attention is repelling what's unpleasant. We can see that really relatively quickly. And we can be more aware of what it is for us that gets us into this whole game of papancha. And we can actually, and so again, thinking isn't the problem. It's just the relationship we have to our thinking mind in many ways that's the ultimate fruit of this practice. Is the mind will continue to judge, the mind will continue to attach to fixed views, the mind will continue to crave, the mind will continue to tell you that you are you, and that is not going to stop. A lot of times people think they're going to meditate their way out of themselves. You know, a lot of times people say, the Buddha said there's no self. That's not what he said. He said that in many ways this papancha, this mental anguish, is born in this idea of I'm attached to this idea of I am. And so papancha is this kind of negative feedback loop that we get pulled into. And it's processual, right? It's not about shutting it off. It's not about getting rid of, it's about noticing that it's true and that in noticing that we have a relationship to that part of thinking and that we can all think ourselves into a really, some of the worst experiences I've had in my life were in my mind. They weren't even happening. Some of them were. And so a lot of times what that does, even a horrific experience like somebody dying or some of the experience I had, those were short moments, but they tend to play out. There's a reverberation in papancha that kind of repeats. In the Second Noble Truth, the Buddha talks about craving being repetitive. Well, papancha is repetitive. It continues to pull our attention. It continues to spin out. And what we need to do is be aware of it. We need to go, oh. We need to notice when the attention is getting pulled into that. And there's, I also was looking at, you know, so you say all this thing like, okay, well, what am I going to do about it? Like, what's the antidote? And like most things, I was a little surprised, but I wasn't totally surprised that the antidote, in many ways, the embodied antidote of dealing with papancha is actually friendliness. Is actually, on one level, having wise, skillful friends. That means associating with people who are wise, people who understand things on this level. That what really cools down papancha is to just associate with the wise. And also to have a friendly attitude towards the craving, towards the self, the idea of the self. A friendly kind of humble attitude towards the fixed views of like going like, I'm pretty sure this is true, but maybe I'm wrong. You know, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe this isn't how it is. Because there's nothing friendly about a fixed view, you know. And so friendliness is or ease or even metta is what we want to cultivate in a really, really holistic way is what's always going to make papancha cool down. And so being aware of it's helpful, but being friendly with it at the same time, having a quality of ease or humility around, like, papancha isn't going anywhere. It's not going to go away. It's going to continue. And so what is my relationship to that? Is it going to be more of an ease, more of a humility of like, okay, like, whew, rather than A lot of times what happens is we just hate it and we just want it to be gone. We want to shut it off. We come into meditation and we go, okay, I'm gonna for the next half an hour, I'm not going to think about one thing. And if you sit down with that attitude, you're going to be really bummed. Papancha is going to own you. It's going to go, really? You don't want to think about anything? What about this? It just loves that. It's already got you hooked and spinning. So I'm trying to think if there's anything else I want. It's a big topic, and it's a very important topic because I think it's one of the most effective ways to understand that thinking isn't the problem. But there's a certain type of thinking, and there's a mechanic to the certain type of thinking that is the problem. And we want to kind of get to know that. As the Buddha always says, the first aspect of the First Noble Truth is dukkha parinya, to fully know dukkha. Part of fully knowing dukkha is realizing, accepting, and just being like aware of this constant, almost relentless mechanics of papancha. And that it's not going to stop. But I can be more aware of it. I can have a relationship to it that's much, much more wise, much more caring. And that's what's going to free you. So, yeah, that's papancha for you. You probably know what it is now, don't you? So if you have any questions,